Dr. Vijay and all of you. Today, discuss on the topic of the mind. We speak on the topic of managing and mastering the monkey mind. So, mind is a word which has many meanings. For example, Albert Einstein may be called the greatest mind of the 20th century. Where the word mind refers to the intellectual faculty of a person. Or the word mind can mean, keep that in your mind. That means remember it. Or the word mind can also refer to the idea of memorizing something or paying attention. Pay your mind to this. That means pay attention to this. It can mean recollection, it can mean attention, it can mean cognition. The Bhagavad Gita uses the word mind in a more specific sense. The Bhagavad Gita explains that the mind is the subtle faculty within us. If we have a computer, the computer has a software, computer has a physical hardware, has a software, and there is a user. So the software is itself invisible. We can say this is the place where the software is stored, but we can't point to the software directly. So similarly, the subtle element, this is a software interfaces between the user and the hardware. So similarly, the mind is, in the Bhagavad Gita's analysis, the subtle element which interfaces between us, spiritual beings, and the physical body which we have and the world around us. So, to make this a little more clear, all of us at different times sense some voice speaking within us. For example, right now I'm speaking to all of you, but there's a voice speaking inside me. That voice is saying that you're going to forget what you're going to speak. And you're going to make a fool of yourself. So, the voice within speaks in different voices, different tones, but there is something within us which speaks in various ways. Now, whatever happens, there's something within which passes comments. You know, if somebody walks in, okay, this person not dressed very well, this person walks like a slouch. There's that. Everything, there's some comment which keeps being passed on. So, what is this faculty? What is this thing within us that is speaking these things? So, that is the Bhagavad Gita says the mind. So, usually we think of external and internal in terms of the body. So, for example, this flask is external to me, it is outside me. And if there's some thought within me, I'm thinking of something, I think that is inside me. But what the Bhagavad Gita tells us is that everything inside me is not me. Everything inside me is not me. That means there is that we, of course, as spiritual beings are there. But along with us, there is a software. We could say, which has been programmed by our own past habits, past desires, past experiences. I believe most of you know about the soul briefly. So the soul is said to be Sat Chit Ananda. Have you heard this term? Sat Chit Ananda. Okay. So Sat is a Sanskrit word which means eternal. And Chit is conscious, Ananda is joyful. So, Sat is a Sanskrit word. Now, in English, there is no such word as Sat. So, as an author, I often write things, and after I want to read writing, when I want to proofread them, I have a text-to-speech software, read it. So, when the text-to-speech software read this, if I write, the soul is Sat Chit Ananda. The software changes it to, while reading it, it reads it that the soul is Saturday Chit Ananda. So it has changed the word Sat to Saturday.
So here, it's something is auto, something like autocorrect that is working, but the autocorrect is working incorrectly. So I type Sat Chit Ananda, and it happens sometimes in MS Word also. I type Sat Chit Ananda, and it gets changed to Saturday Chit Ananda. So this is an example of an inbuilt program. So just as there is a program for spell check and maybe autocorrect. So now, similarly, there is a program within us. And that program, where that program is stored, that is the mind. So this program, the mind often contains programs that are not healthy for us. And if we don't deal with these unhealthy programs, we will end up underusing our energies, or rather dissipating our energies and not fulfilling our potential. You know, when there's a machine, and if the machine has a lot of friction internally, then the friction sucks its energy. And then whatever external power is coming into the machine, a lot of it gets consumed in the friction, and the external productivity of the machine decreases. Similarly, there are self-sabotaging programs within the mind. And these actually make us underuse our potential. So managing the mind essentially means correcting these self-sabotaging programs. So I'll talk about, there can be many programs, and some of the specifics of the programs will vary from person to person. But I'll talk about some general patterns which are often unhealthy. So the first is that the mind makes us fight more battles than we need to. The mind makes us fight more battles than we need to. Suppose there is some kind of confrontation going on, war or whatever, and there is one person here, one person here, both of them fighting. It's an equal fight. But if there's one person here and there are three people here, it becomes a much more difficult fight to win. So the mind, when we have to do something, when I say that the mind makes us fight more battles than we need to, that means if we are doing one thing at a particular time, the mind adds the past and the future to the present. And by adding the past and the future to the present, the mind makes the present situation far tougher than what it needs to be. So, I'll talk about this in two terms, about how the mind adds the past and the present, future. So, for example, if I'm giving my first public speech, and that time I stutter and stammer, and I'm not able to give a very good performance, then at that time, the mind immediately goes off into the past. And maybe in the childhood, if I had some stammering problem, mind starts reminding me of that. Or maybe I had knew some friend who would always stammer, and who had a lot of difficulty, and I start thinking, maybe I'll become like that. And basically, the present is some problem. But the mind, by adding events from the past, by adding memories from the past, burdens us. So, if there is a porter who is paid to carry, say, 10 kg weight. And imagine that porter adds 20 kg weight more on top. And is oneself carrying 30 kg. And is going to be paid only for 10 kg. So who would want to add more weight that one wants to carry? So we all have work to do. But the mind transforms work into workload. The mind transforms work into workload. That means, rather than doing just the job at hand, the mind makes us think of, oh, that time I had to do so much work and it took so much trouble. That time when I tried to do this, this went wrong. And then that happened. And If there was just the work to be done, we can do it. But when the work becomes a workload, then it becomes a crushing burden. Then that dissipates our energy. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says in 13th chapter, 21st verse, Karya karana kartrutve hetu prakriti ruchyate purusha sukha dukkhanam bhoktrutve hetu ruchyate. So he is essentially saying that karya karana kartrutve, that cause and effect, this causal chain happens in the outer world. And that is where events take place. But experiences are what happen in the inner world. And our experiences are determined by our mentality, by our worldview. Say someone is carrying a glass of water and somehow you slip and fall and the water gets spilled everywhere. Then that's what has happened. That's an event that has happened. Maybe somebody pushed. Maybe there was something slippery on the floor. Somehow it slipped and fell. But at that time, the mind adds a burdening message. You are a clumsy buffoon. And with this message, okay, what was the small event? Okay, slipped and fell. You know, others may laugh at me. I can also laugh. Just get up and move on with it. But when the mind interprets the event, then that event doesn't remain just an event in the outer world. It becomes an experience, and often it becomes a disheartening experience. So the mind makes us fight. So if I have slipped and fallen, I can get up. But when the mind adds a whole gamut of emotions and its own interpretations of that event based on the emotions, then the problem becomes much more difficult. So life determines our problems, but our mind determines their size. Life determines the problems that we are going to face, but our mind determines the size, how big the problem is going to be. The more we think of a problem, maybe there are some movies in which there are some shape-shifting people shown. So there are two people are fighting, and then one person suddenly starts becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then this other person is trying to fight, feels like I'm a dwarf. How can I fight with such a giant? So like that, when we dwell on a problem, when the mind dwells on a problem, then that mental energy gets invested in the problem. And when that mental energy gets invested in the problem starts becoming bigger and bigger and bigger. And as compared to that, we start feeling, I'm so small. Sometimes a small event happens. It's like somebody slips and some water spills. But that person starts thinking that, I am a clumsy buffoon. That person may after that become afraid to carry water anywhere. And just a simple act of carrying water can cause stress, can cause anxiety. So what is happening here? When we unguardedly let the mind dwell on certain events, certain things that have happened in the outer world, then the mind causes that problem to seem to become bigger and bigger and bigger. And in comparison, we start feeling, I am so small, I am so worthless. And then we disempower ourselves. We disempower ourselves. So the mind makes us fight more battles than we need to by adding past memories to whatever has happened at present and by adding its own interpretation of what has happened. So another thing that the mind does is it adds future. The future, the mind often adds dystopian imagery, all kinds of horrible events which may come up. I'm driving a car and I see some car crash has happened. And the mind starts imagining, maybe when I'm driving, my car brakes may fail. Or my wheel may come off. Maybe I've seen some movie also where the wheel has gone off. And then the mind starts running on overdrive. It's imagining all kinds of terrible scenes. So, the mind sometimes takes some stimuli, and for different people, there may be different stimuli that might trigger the mind. But when the stimuli get triggered, then the mind starts playing a horror movie. And in that horror movie, we are not the spectator. We are the spectacle. We are the person who are the victims. And this horror movie in which we become the victim, that can paralyze us. So fear is not a problem. Fear of what comes after fear is the problem. Fear is a healthy, protective human instinct. If I look down from a big height, at that time, the fear which you feel on seeing a huge drop, that's a natural human psychological defense mechanism to protect us from danger. So, it is not possible that we can ever be free from worry or anxiety entirely. That some amount of worry or anxiety makes us duly cautious. Sometimes some people are completely free from worry, and then that makes others filled with worry about them. As they say, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. Children sometimes don't understand there is some danger. So children will just think, oh, this fire looks so shiny, let me put my hand over there. They are fearless, and that makes their mothers fearful. So fear itself is not undesirable. Similarly, worry or anxiety is not itself undesirable. But when the healthy fear, even the healthy worry, when that sends us off on a dystopian fantasy, when it makes us imagine all worst case scenarios whose probability is very low. Once there was a lady, every 3 months she would go to a doctor. Doctor, have I got cancer? Have I got cancer? Have I got cancer? Doctor would say, you're perfectly healthy, you've got no symptoms, don't worry about it. No, have I got cancer? Have I got cancer? So after 40 years going like this, finally doctor told, yes, you have got some cancer, preliminary cancer. See, I was right. Now, yes, a regular health checkup is good, but paranoia is unhealthy. So the mind, when it goes into the future, it goes into all sorts of negative fantasies. Dystopia. Utopia is unrealistically positive fantasies. Dystopia is unrealistically negative fantasies. So then when that happens, that can also paralyze us. So sometimes when people get panic attacks, sometimes the panic attacks can be because of some psychiatric problems, but quite often the panic attacks are simply because the mind is going on an uncontrolled flight. So when it goes on this flight, then we start envisioning the worst possible scenario. Now there is, certainly, when I talk about the mind going to the past or going to the future, this itself is not unhealthy. That is fine. Going to the past, to learn from the past, is good. If say, last time I was speaking, I stuttered and stammered. If I recollect that and think, what caused the stammer? Maybe I was looking at some person who was glaring at me, and just that looking at that person started disconcerting me. Maybe then this time I can avoid looking at them. The people who are afraid of speaking in public, and yet you can't avoid eye contact with people when you're speaking in public. So sometimes when people get panicky on seeing others, they are advised, you look between two people. Both will think you are looking at them. And you won't be looking at anyone. So if we think calmly what triggered some undesirable action in the past, we can learn from that. So learning from the past is good, but learning from the past is possible when we are in control. But when the mind is in control, we don't learn from the past, we fall back into the past. That means we just simply, we paralyze ourselves by negative memories of the past. And how to differentiate between these two? that, you know, whether the mind is in control or whether I am in control. That I'll talk in a little later part. But the same I apply to the future. Now, preparing for the future is important. So, if there are some dangers, preparing for those dangers is good. Yes, for example, if somebody is flying by plane, and at that time the person learns, okay, these are the security measures, the safety measures that have to be taken. This is how I should use the oxygen bag. This is how I should use the water bag. All the various things that are there, precautions, learning them is good. But if every time a person is going to enter a plane, and as soon as the air hostess starts explaining the security measures that are taken, and one starts thinking, oh, my plane is going to crash, and I'm going to fall into the ocean, and my water bag will not inflate, and I will drown. And even before the drowning, one is drowning in the mind. So this sort of unrealistic and worst case scenarios, in this case, there is, firstly, they're unlikely to happen. Secondly, even if they are likely to happen, what can we do about it? There is nothing we can do except prepare. Take whatever precautions are possible, we take them. But unfortunately, when the mind goes into this dystopian fantasy mode, it starts playing this horror movie and we just lose it. So especially in high pressure sports, sometimes when there is a defining moment, a final moment, and sometimes just some players lose their cool at that time. And what are the simple move to make in football, simple shot to play in baseball, person just fools up. And then you say that, you know, these people choke under pressure. He or she choked under pressure. So what is that choking? What caused that choking? So often nowadays, many sports, whether it is cricket or baseball or football, they say it is a game of the mind, more than a game of the body, or as much as the game of the body. So people have to be mentally strong to succeed. And that what applies to sports applies to our whole life also. So envisioning future possibilities, future problems, and preparing for them is good. But just passively letting the mind paint up all kinds of terrible scenarios, that is disempowering. And that is undesirable. So now, I talked about how the mind disempowers us. I said the mind makes us fight more battles than it needed to by adding the past and the future. And the mind adds meaning. It interprets events in such a way that they become sometimes disheartening experiences for us. Further, the mind basically flitters. Flitters means like a bird may move from one place to another, to another, to another, or a monkey may move from one place to another. So the mind doesn't focus. No. A fan, it moves round and round and round. But the fan gets nowhere. It just stays where it is all the time. Our mind also goes round and round and round. At least the fan used some air. But the mind often does nothing. What the mind does quite often is, it puts our thoughts and our actions out of sync. So, out of sync. So, I'm doing one thing, I'm thinking, oh, I did that. Did I do that right or did I do that wrong? And I have to do that. So, there's A, B, C. When I'm doing A, I'm worrying whether I'll do B right or not. When I'm doing B, I'm worrying whether I did A right or not. And I'm worrying whether I'll do C right or not. And the person, by the time I come to C, I realize, oh, I did A also wrong and B also wrong. Then I'm doing C and I'm worrying, oh, I have to do A and B again. And because of that worry, I go and do A and B and then I remember I did C also wrong. So I have to do C also. So the mind puts our thoughts and our actions out of sync. And because of that also, our energy gets dissipated. We are often habituated to think of our schedule, think of our time availability in terms of activities. Okay, in the morning I have to do this, in the afternoon I have to do this, in the evening I have to do this. And that is a fine enough way of analyzing our day and our time expenditure. But that is not complete enough. Because our time is not consumed only by our activities. It is also consumed by our thoughts. If we had an unpleasant interaction with someone, and then as students we go into the class, we are looking at the looking at the whiteboard or looking at the teacher, and after half an hour, what happened? So we are just thinking, why did that person say that? Now when that person said, I should have said this, that would have been a fitting comeback. Why didn't I say that? I never think on my feet. You know, I should learn to think on my feet. Next time he says that, I'll say this, and the mind is gone and so on. So that event, that person maybe snubbing us, it happened maybe within 10 seconds. But sometimes that one incident and the thought that is created, that may take 10 hours. And we never factor it in our schedule. But thoughts take time. And when thoughts take time, it is essentially the mind that is taking the time. So when we consider this fact that the mind puts our thoughts and actions out of sync, then we need to recognize, how do I get them into sync? One is we just say, okay, concentrate. Yes, sometimes when, now all these problems which I talked about, these are sometimes thought of as problems because of lack of willpower. Say that is, why do you worry so much? Cool down, don't worry. Now sometimes that may help, but cool down. Suppose somebody had a high temperature, 102. Cool down, man. You can't cool down like that. There's a physical disease that is there. And the cooling down the temperature of the body is not just a matter of our own willpower. There's a temperature I've got. Then I need a proper process. I take some medicines, and that will help the temperature to go down. I need willpower. I need the willpower to take the medicines regularly. I need the willpower to make sure that I don't expose myself to stimuli that may make the fever worse. I don't go out in the cold or whatever. But willpower alone, just as it is not enough to cool our physical temperature, similarly, willpower alone may not always be enough to cool our mental temperature. And the mind gets hot, we just tell a person, cool down. Yes, it can help to some extent, but there is a limitation to that. Just like if a person is very, always habitually morose, whatever suggestion we give, that person is expert in finding problems with that suggestion. And that time, why do you always have a hung face? Smile a bit, man. So now smiling can help. Now smiling can make not only a person look better, smiling can make a person feel better also. But there is a limit to that. If I am sitting on this chair and there are 50 thorns on this chair, and somebody tells me, smile, you'll feel better. Well, maybe, but not really. Just a shift of attitude is not enough when there are real problems out there. Shift of attitude is important, but the real problems need also to be dealt with. So the Bhagavad Gita explains that prashant manasam yenam yoginam sukham uttamam upaiti shant rajasam brahmabhutam akalmasham. In the 6th chapter, 27th verse of the Bhagavad Gita, it is said that brahmabhutam, when we understand our spiritual nature, not just understand, but when we experience our spiritual nature, then prashant manasam, the mind becomes peaceful, the mind becomes calm. Upaiti shant rajasam, all the passion, the agitation, the anxiety within the mind becomes pacified. So the mental temperature cools down. So what does it mean to experience our spiritual nature? And how does that calm the mind down? If somebody is in ocean. In the ocean, there are always going to be waves. And when the waves are there, the person is going to be shaken. Up, down, up, down, up, down. That's inevitable. But if that same person is in a boat, then the waves are still going to be there and the shaking is still going to be there, but it's going to be much less. And if that boat is anchored to something heavy and firm, then the shaking will be much, much, much less. So in this case, we're not stopping the waves, but we're stopping our shaking. So the world we live in is a place of change. The weather changes, the job scenario changes, the moods of our teachers change, the moods of our friends and colleagues change, our own mind's mood changes. The same thing which I like today, I just find it boring tomorrow. The mind can say about in a relationship, the mind can say, I can't live without you. And a few days later, the mind can say, I can't live with you. So, this is the oscillation. The changes constantly keep happening. And in fact, if we look at the world around us, the only thing constant is change. So, everything keeps changing. And because of this change, it naturally creates some uncertainty, some anxiety, some worry, some insecurity. Now, researchers have studied anxiety quite exhaustively in the last century. So, some very interesting features have been found that people in the first world often have fairly good amount of material security, social conveniences and comforts. As compared to that, people in the third world have far greater uncertainty, insecurity, inconveniences. And yet, the researchers have found that people in the first world suffer from higher anxiety levels than people in the third world. Not only that, when people from the third world come to the first world, their anxiety levels also go up. So now, what is the reason for this? If the externals are relatively more comfortable, more available, then what causes anxiety? What is causing the high anxiety level is not outer uncertainty, but inner instability. Inner instability means that this is not a matter of comparing the first world and third world. It is more a matter of a materialistic worldview and a spiritual worldview. In a materialistic worldview, matter is all that matters. That is functional materialism. You know, even if there is some God exists, okay, he exists somewhere, I exist here, you know, he's happy there, I'm happy here. Why bother about him? So God, spiritual side, soul, our spiritual side, all these don't matter. That is functional materialism. And then there is fanatical materialism. Fanatical materialism is matter is all that exists. Nothing else exists. So of course, This worldview is both philosophically and scientifically flawed. I won't go into that direction. But the result, I'm talking about mind, managing the mind here. So in the materialistic worldview, matter is all that matters. And matter is always changing. So because of the constant change of matter, there is uncertainty. And that causes anxiety. And when there is nothing unchanging to hold on to, then the anxiety levels shoot up. So what we need to deal with the mind's oscillation, I said that the waves are going to come, if there is a boat and the boat is further anchored to some strong, heavy, immovable object, then the oscillation will be much lesser. So like that, we live in a world that is largely materialistic. So to manage the mind, if we have a spiritual community, if we have spiritual friends, we have some spiritual association regularly, that places us in a boat. And if we connect ourselves with the ultimate anchor, that is God, who is revealed in the Bhagavad Gita to be Krishna, then that connection stabilizes us. So prayer is when we speak to God, and meditation is when we hear God. So both are ways of communicating with God. Prayer is when we speak our heart to Him, and meditation is when we hear God. So there are different ways of meditating, and the mantra that we chanted just now, so that is one of the most accessible forms of meditation. Why is it the most accessible? Because sound acts as an elevator to raise our consciousness from the material to the spiritual level. So the spiritual sound, whether it is singing and we did kirtans, or it is individual prayerful meditation, if we just try to fix our consciousness on the sound will raise our consciousness upwards. And as we feel ourselves rising upwards, the uncertainties, the insecurities, the worries, they will be there, but they won't worry us so much. We will be calmer and we will be able to deal with the situation better. So suppose a person is in a disaster afflicted area. There is a fire, there is flood, there is live electricity, wires exposed. The person is in anxiety. And suppose a rescue helicopter comes from above, drops a rope and pulls up. That person is still in the same area, but now one is raised up. And because of being raised up, although the problem is there, one doesn't feel immediately threatened by the problem. So if we connect with our spiritual side, if we connect with the supreme spiritual reality God, then that connection raises us above our situations. And then we can be concerned without being disturbed. We can be concerned. It is not that spirituality means we don't worry about anything. We all have issues which we have to deal with. But we want to deal with the issues. We don't want to be devoured by the issues. And without a spiritual connection, that is what happens. We get consumed by the worries and whatever associated negative meanings come up from that. But when we connect with ourselves with spiritual sound, that raises us up. And then we can deal with the situation. We can find, this is the problem, and these are the possible things that can happen, and this is how I can deal with it. So with respect to going, I'll quickly go back and I'll conclude the class. I'll talk about, with the spiritual perspective, how can we deal with the mind's various misdirecting habits, the bad programs that are there within us. So with respect to the past and the future. So if we are spiritually connected, then we are calm. When we are calm, then if we look at the past, now we are aware. Just like if I said to someone right now, you are a lazy bum, that person would feel insulted. How dare you speak like this to me? And that's natural, and we will either counter it, that person will either counter it, how dare you speak like that, or that at least if there is some truth in it, that person will try to correct oneself so that it will no longer be true. So when some insulting criticism comes from outside, we actually resist it and try to correct it. But when that same label is offered by the mind within us, instead of countering it, we accept it. For example, if I was supposed to wake up early and do some work, and somehow in the sleep we become inactive, but often the hand is active to switch off the alarm. Switch off the alarm and then they come. You are a lazy fool. Now when the mind starts goading, what happens is, when the alarm is ringing, at that time the mind says, sleep for some more time, maybe 5 minutes. And then that 5 minutes become 25 minutes in the mind. Same mind which told us to sleep, he says, why did you sleep so much? You are such a fool. You are lazy, you are useless, you will never be able to do anything in your life. Some small 20 minutes sleeping becomes a statement about your life. You will never be able to do anything in your life. If somebody else said that to us, we would be angry with that person. But rather than when the mind says that, instead of being angry, we start becoming depressed. Oh, maybe it is true. You know, if two people were fighting a boxing match, you know, there is A and there is B. And A gives a bad punch and B falls down. So now B has fallen down. Now it's a bad punch. Okay, I've fallen down. Now if B wants to rise and fight, we should look around at one's coach or look at one's friends and they'll say, come on, get up, fight. But suppose B has fallen down and then asks, say, hey, will I be able to win in this match? He will say, never! Isn't it? So same way, the mind only knocks us down. The mind only made me oversleep. And then I asked the mind, oh, will I become a better person? Never! So it is like that. So I said, we need positive spiritual association which will inspire us to bring out the best within us. And so when, as I said, if we have, if we practice meditation regularly, if we understand the spiritual wisdom of the Gita, then that helps us to catch the mind in the act. Otherwise, the mind makes us act, and many times we do something and then you wonder, why did I do that? I never wanted to do that. Why did I do that? But it is as if some stranger had entered into us, some ghost had possessed us and made us act like that. But when we meditate regularly, because we are spiritually connected, when the mind starts pushing us, we get, hey, this is the mind talking. So recognizing the enemy is practically the biggest part of dealing with the enemy when it comes to the mind, because the mind is inside us, and unfortunately we tend to think that whatever is inside me is me. So once we understand, okay, there is something within me which is hostile to me, then we are on the watch out. So the spiritual wisdom enables us to distance ourselves from the mind, to become a little more analytical about our own thinking. And then when we catch the mind, we can stop the mind. But if we don't catch it, there's no chance of stopping it. And this is actually especially possible when we do meditation. When we do meditation, the mind goes here, mind goes there. That's the time when we can observe. Okay, the mind is going. Let me bring it back. The mind is going. Let me bring it back. And we focus on the spiritual sound. And by that, the mind slowly calms down. And the Bhagavad Gita says something very interesting, that the mind can be both our enemy and our friend. Bandhuratma atmanastasya yenatmaiva atmananita anatmanastu chatrutve varate tatmaiva chatruvat. So, it says, chapter 6th verse, that for one who has controlled the mind becomes the friend. And for one who has failed to control it, the mind remains the enemy. What this means is that, again, if I'm thinking about the past, but the mind is in control, then I will simply become paranoid. But if I'm thinking about the past, you know, while being in control, then I can analyze and I can learn from the past. So the way to control the mind, the best way, is by connecting with a reality which is far greater than the mind. And the highest such reality is God, Krishna. And He becomes accessible to us through spiritual sound. The very word mantra means manas trayate iti mantra. The sound which frees us from the various problems that the mind creates. And to conclude, I'll quickly summarize, then you can ask some questions. I started by talking about how the word mind can have many meanings. In the Bhagavad Gita, the mind refers to the a thing within us which often works against us. And this, the mind works against us in many ways. I talked about a few. The most fundamental strategy by which the mind works against us is it makes us fight more battles than we need to. By adding past to the present, by adding past everything that has gone wrong, or by adding future to the present, by adding, painting up everything that can go wrong, or by adding meaning to event, by adding its own interpretation to its event. One mistake and you are a good for nothing fool. So the mind in this way disempowers us. And the way to deal with the mind is, yes, it's not just a matter of willpower, as I was saying. Just as physical temperature cannot be cooled just by willpower, similarly mental temperature cannot be cooled just by willpower. Yes, willpower helps, but willpower needs to be coupled with a process. And that process is connecting with the unchanging reality. Now, what fuels the mind in its various undesirable fantasies is change. Change which causes anxiety, change which causes insecurity. And change causes anxiety not so much because of the external change, but internally if there is a materialistic worldview, then that causes further anxiety. As I said, in the first world, anxiety levels are higher than the third world. So, just as we need medicine to cure, to bring the physical temperature down, similarly to bring the mental temperature down, we need the medicine of meditation. And what does meditation do? It gives us something unchanging to connect with. God is the supreme unchanging reality, and just as a boat in an ocean will become steady if anchored, similarly, we, when connected with God, become steadier. And the best way to do that is through spiritual sound, because spiritual sound acts like an elevator to raise our consciousness from the material to the spiritual level. And with ourselves spiritually connected, we can catch the mind. When the mind starts taking us in wrong directions, we will have the inner clarity. Okay, this is the mind speaking. I don't have to listen to it. I don't have to think about these things. Let me focus on what I can do. So that capacity to perceive the mind becomes enhanced. And then the capacity to counter its influences also becomes enhanced. When we connect ourselves spiritually through the wisdom of the spiritual literature like the Bhagavad Gita, and practically through the process of meditation, which gives us experience of a reality higher than the material. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
I was wondering, how then did we acquire the mind, and why is its default setting so negative?
Yeah. How did we acquire the mind, and why is its default setting negative? The mind is a part of the apparatus that we need to interact with the body, with the world. So we are spiritual beings, and as spiritual beings, we cannot directly interact with the world around us. Just like if astronauts go into space, they need space suits. Similarly, we need an interface for connecting with the world. Shrotram chakshuh sparshanam cha rasanam ghranam eva cha adhishthaya manashchayam vishayan upasevate. So in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 15th chapter, 8th verse, Krishna says that the five senses, knowledge acquiring senses, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the skin, they are all centered around the mind. And through these, we vishayanupasevat, we seek pleasure in external objects. So by our very nature, we are pleasure seeking creatures. And when we are spiritually unaware, we seek pleasure in external things. So the mind, the mind is a part of the necessary apparatus that we have for interfacing with the world. And this is, the soul is eternal. So the soul is eternal, and the soul, whenever it is present, in interfacing with the material world, it needs a mechanism. And that mechanism includes the mind. So the word that is used for this in the Bhagavad Gita is anadi. Anadi means beginningless. Just as the soul is beginningless, similarly, the time when we acquire the mind, that is also beginningless. But more importantly is that why does it have negative scripts? That is because of the influences from externals in this as well as in the present as well as in the past. So because we are living in largely a materialistic culture, so we are by default, we are by nature pleasure-seeking creatures. But where we seek pleasure, that will be determined by the culture we live in. So if the culture is materialistic, then naturally we start seeking pleasure in materialistic things. And then that causes anxieties. The problem among the many, one problem with materialism is that it makes us dependent for our happiness on things that are not in our control. The external things, whether it be wealth or position or power or even our own looks. These are not really in our control for a very long time. For some time they may be in control, but they slip away from us over time. So when we become dependent on those things, and further, it is not just our possession of those things, it is our possessing them more than others. Not only should I look good, I should look better than others. Not only should I secure good marks, I should secure better marks than others. Not only should I have a new smartphone, my smartphone should be smarter than that of others. So this, especially in today's culture, you know, we live in a not just a materialistic culture, but an aggressively materialistic culture. Aggressively materialistic means that, you know, we are exposed to the best of everything. You know, that means I have a cell phone, but the advertisements all around me are showing me cell phones which are far better than mine. Now, I may have a decent physique, but the movies, the billboards, they're all showing people with the easy way to become miserable is to watch advertisements. What happens? Advertising essentially show us all the things that we don't have. That's how they make us purchase those things. So, yes, because we live in an aggressively materialistic culture, so quite often we are bombarded with the things that we don't have. And that creates negative mental patterns. Oh, your memory is not good enough. Your speech is not good enough. Your intelligence is not good enough. Essentially, all these messages boil down to, although the people may not speak this directly, they say, you are not good enough. And then that can be very demoralizing. So, it's like with respect to today, obesity is a big problem. And it is, people are caught in a terrible crunch. On one side, we have so many advertisements of food items. Oh, this looks so good. Eat this, eat that. And on top of that, there are advertisements of all kinds of fine tasting food, which is all filled with fat quite often. And along with that, there are advertisements of people who are super slim. So, what do you do? It becomes mental torture practically. So, because of being exposed to excessive materialism, and naturally the result is that we can't have all the things that are being glamorized, so that creates negative thought patterns. So to the extent we can avoid unnecessary exposure to materialistic stimuli, we'll find that the negative thought patterns will decrease. And it may also happen that in our social circle, be it our family or our friends, there might be people who have given us negative messages. So, because of that also, negative thought patterns come up. And if we learn that, then we need to keep a distance from them. And then that also can help us to counter those negative thought patterns. The Bhagavad Gita gives us the very encouraging message that no matter what the world thinks of us, No, God always loves us. Krishna is right there within our heart, and he's always there. And his presence in our heart, his love for us, doesn't depend on anything. There is nothing that anyone can do that can stop God from loving them. Nothing that we can do that can stop him. So, right now this may just be a theoretical concept for us, but if you practice meditation and experience the elevation, the pacification of consciousness by that, we start realizing the reality of God's presence and God's love. And that becomes the greatest inner security by which you can counter the negative mental habits that we may have acquired in the past. Is that answering your question? Thank you. Yeah.
So you basically, the message was that we spiritualize God. This is the best way to solve the problem. So what happens when we find ourselves in serious doubt of the existence of God and spiritual, and the, you know, that we are spirit? So, you know, this also comes from the mind, so it makes it very difficult. So how do we deal with that doubt that comes?
So how do we deal with the doubt about the existence
of the spiritual reality of God? Doubt is a natural human emotion. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, an important devotee. Doubt is recognized as a sign of intelligence. When only an intelligent person can doubt. That's why I see that there are many countries where advertisements
to
children below particular.
I switched off?
Okay, sorry.
Oh, were you able to hear? Should I repeat?
Repeat,
okay.
Did you hear the question or did you
hear anything? Okay, I'll start. Okay, it's going off.
Am I audible now?
Hare Krishna.
Okay. Am I audible?
Oh. I have to touch this. Hare Krishna. Okay. Okay, fine. Hare Krishna. Am I audible now?
Yes.
So the question is that sometimes we may have doubts about God's existence and the existence of anything spiritual. So how do we these doubts also come from the mind. How do we deal with them? Yes. So doubt is a function of the intelligence. The Srimad Bhagavatam, which is an important devotional classic, states that doubt is the beginning of intelligence. The first function of the intelligence is to doubt. That's why in many countries, advertisements to children who are very small are legally banned. Because the children don't have the intelligence to evaluate. What is this? They can't doubt. If they're shown something, they just think this is right. This is how it is. I just get this doll, I get this, I'll be happy. So, doubting is a sign of intelligence. But doubting is not the only sign of intelligence. we should doubt. There are things which should be doubted in life. But one of the things is we should learn to doubt also. Now doubt can tell us what is wrong. Doubt can never tell us what is right. Actually, if you study philosophy, somebody starts studying philosophy as an academic discipline, then you know, within a few years, one can become trained. As soon as someone presents his philosophy, you can start pointing holes in it. This problem. Then it becomes more like an intellectual game. Whatever argument you give, I'll find faults with it. Now, using doubt to acquire knowledge is like using immobility for transportation, for motion. The two are opposite. So, when I said we should learn to doubt, it means We need to know that doubt can tell us what is wrong, but doubt itself will never tell us what is right. So if we want to know what is right, eventually we need to go beyond doubt. So now, with respect to doubts about the, say, the existence of God. The existence of God can be understood in various ways. The very existence, sometimes I say, for some people think that science and science has disproven God, or that this scientific theory or that scientific theory. There are many atheistic scientists. There's one atheist who wrote quite a well-known book. He said, how everything came from nothing. Science has proven that God does not exist. We don't need God for the universe. The book was How Everything Came from Nothing. Now, if you read that book, the nothing is quite a thing. Now, basically, to have nothing produce everything, the scientist has had to redefine nothing so that it is something. Quite a thing, in fact. That nothing is a complex quantum mechanical vacuum which requires pages upon pages of the most abstract mathematics to describe. So the point is that science, and quite often many doubts come from science about the existence of God. But science and God can seem contradictory if we do not understand what science rests on. See, science offers explanations for things. But science, how does science offer explanations? That means, if everything just came from a bang, everything was, so if we just remove God entirely, remove spirit entirely, and assume a purely materialistic worldview, then what is the story of the universe? Nothing existed because of nothing. Then because of nothing, something happened to nothing. And because of that something, from nothing, everything came. And not only that, not only is the question of origin there, science has been able to explain many things. But it has been able to explain things because of its ability to observe and find patterns in nature. So, millions of people before Newton saw fruit falling. Most of them picked it up and ate the fruit. Newton thought, why did this fruit fall? And now, this can point to the intelligence of Newton. And yes, intelligence has to be given due credit. But the very question, why did the fruit fall? Indicates an assumption that there is an answer to the why. If I got just a scribble of paper which made no sense to me, then I would just throw it away. But if I saw the scribble of paper and I started thinking, maybe this is a message written in some language I don't know, and I start comparing this script with various scripts that I know, and I start taking the labor to find out what it means, which language it is written in, that taking that labor itself assumes that there may be some meaning over there. So the very quest of science rests on the assumption that there is order in the universe. The question comes, where did this order come from? And not only is there order in the universe, there is order of mathematical precision. Now, F is equal to gm1 m2 upon r square. That is what Newton came up with based on his observation and the principle of gravity. Now, if everything has just come without any higher intelligence anywhere involved, just by the random changes in matter, then our brain is just a random collection of stardust. And the world around us is also a random arrangement that has come from Stardust. And on top of that, mathematics is just a concept within the biochemical patterns in my neuronal cells. So why in the wide world should the behavior of objects outside correlate with the patterns of the ways in which the electrochemicals in the brain cells fire? I hope this point is clear.
Okay,
I'll put it in a different way. Science offers explanations. God offers the explanation for explainability. Science offers explanations. God offers the explanation for explainability. Why is the universe explainable? No, if there are stars moving out, moving in this cosmos, there are atoms moving around, why should their motion correlate with mathematics, which is just a concept in my head? When both my head and the stars have just come from stardust. So God is the explanation for explainability. So it is not that science and God are contradictory. They offer explanations at different levels. Science functions with the premise of looking for material explanations for material phenomena. And it does a great job in giving material explanations. But material explanations are not necessarily the complete explanations. For example, say I came for this program in a car. Now if someone was observing the car, okay, you see, the wheels of the car started moving. Now I can give explanation for this at two levels. One level is, why did the wheels start moving? Oh, because the wheels are connected through a crankshaft and they go to the ignition, and there was a spark in the ignition. Now why was there a spark in the ignition? You go back. Oh, there was a key which was in the vertical position. And the key moved to the horizontal position. And that's why the wheels started moving. That's a correct explanation. Is it a complete explanation? No. I desired to come here. That's why I entered the car. And I had moved the key from the vertical to the horizontal. And the wheels started moving. So, science, by definition, looks for material explanations for material phenomena. And because God is non-material, by definition, science does not find God directly. But that does not mean science and God are contradictory. They are explanations at different levels. So science explains material phenomena through material causes, whereas God is the explanation for the explainability at the material level. There was the famous Indian mathematician, Srinivas Ramanujan. So he said, an equation for me has no meaning unless it represents a thought of God. E is equal to mc square. How did that equality come about? So that equality is a fact which is there in nature. But how did it come about? We have discovered it, but how did it come about? So if it is because of, say, thinking that I am being unscientific by believing anything spiritual, that is the cause of our doubt, then understanding how spiritual and the scientific correlate, that can clarify the doubts. Sometimes the doubts may come because of some problems that come in our life. We think, okay, I'm worshipping God, devoting myself to God. Maybe then that should mean that God should protect me or problems should not come in my life. Then if problems come, that may cause some doubts. So now when that happens, again, if we study scripture carefully, the Bhagavad Gita tells us that this world is a place of misery. What it means is that here our bodies are going to age, they're going to grow old, there are going to be problems in the world. So quite often, to the contrary, the materialistic propaganda tells us, oh, you just buy this and you'll be happy, just get this and you'll be happy. So actually, when we face problems, rather than that causing us doubt. See, yes, you know, the spiritual wisdom literature told that this world is a place of problems, and now I'm experiencing problems. So, it's true. But this is not a pessimistic message. Because the Bhagavad Gita also tells us, yes, there are problems, but we can rise above problems by our connection with God. So, machittaha sarvadurgani mat prasadat tarishasi. In the 18th chapter, 58 verse, Krishna says, if you become conscious of me, you will pass over all obstacles by my grace. So then we can think, rather than doubting, oh, does God really exist? I'm having so many troubles. It's not helping. Yes, God has told through scripture that there are problems in this world. I'm experiencing this to be true. So one part of scripture, I have found it to be true. Now let me see if the other part of scripture is also true. What is the other part? Scripture gives us a process by which we can raise our consciousness to the spiritual level and we can experience relief. The problem itself will not go away, but the mental may not immediately go away, but the mental burden because of the problem subsides. It goes down. And anyone, anywhere, if we turn towards prayer, if we say participate in spiritual music, we experience relief. And we pray to God, we meditate, we experience relief. Now, that is at our level an experience of the reality of God. Bhakti pareshanubhava virakti ranyatracha. Bhakti, devotion, is the process that gives us para isha anubhav, experience of God, who is a higher reality. So, when a baby is very small, at that time, the baby is newborn, the baby doesn't even know that there is something called a mother. All the baby knows is, oh, I just put my mouth over here and I get milk. And say the baby is, and it's cold at night, and the baby is shivering. Then the mother puts a blanket. Oh, at that time, the baby doesn't know there is a mother who loves me and puts the blanket. But the baby experiences the relief from the cold. The baby experiences warmth. And then as the baby grows up, then she starts understanding, oh, there's a mother who loves me. And then when she feels the blanket, oh, my mother has put the blanket. So that understanding happens when she grows up. Similarly, now at our, we are like in spiritual infancy right now. So we can't really perceive the existence of God. But when we turn to Him in prayer and meditation, we can experience relief. We can experience, as I said, the blanket input. We can experience the relief from the anxiety. And that is the experience of the reality of God. And as we move forward, that reality becomes clearer and clearer. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, please.
So Bhagavad Gita says that soul can neither be created nor be destroyed. And once we have a spiritual realization, we go and reach Krishna. So is there a total count in the number of souls? If yes, why there is an increase in the population?
So is the total number of souls fixed? If so, then why is the population increasing? Yeah. See, the population increase and a number of souls, they are related by several underlying assumptions. That's one assumption is that souls are present only in human beings. When we say population is increasing, who has done the population of mosquitoes? Who has done the census of the microbes? You're not done there. One of the things that the Bhagavad Gita says is the soul is sarvagataha. That means it is capable of being present in various bodily forms. It's not present only in human form. The human body is basically, the soul is symptomized by consciousness. Wherever consciousness is present, their soul is there. So the human population which we observe is only one species where the soul is present. So the soul can you mentioned one possibility. The soul, it goes back to God, then it will not come back. That's true. That is like some souls who are getting liberated and going. Some that will cause some population, some we could say some human count to decrease. But that is not the only way of entry or exit. No, the idea of population explosion is based on the notion that it's a closed system. The system is not closed. System is open. There are souls from the lower species who come up. And there are many souls in the human form who keep coming back also. So especially because souls from the lower species come up, that is why the population is not reflective of the total count of the soul. And the population increase as far as the census goes. The Bhagavad Gita states that what we live in is an age called Kali Yuga. And this age is an age characterized by various kinds of problems. One problem is resource scarcity. And that resource scarcity can also result when there is a lot of population increase. So the point is that this question that because the souls are, number of souls is fixed, because the soul cannot be created, that should mean the population should not increase. That is based on a assumption that there are no souls anywhere else. The souls enter from other species, and that's how the soul population can increase. Just like, suppose there was an alien who came to the earth, and that alien was told to observe the population of the earth. And then that alien says, comes to this classroom and observes, hovering at the back. And then they find that, maybe suppose before this classroom was empty. And maybe for 2-3 hours it was empty, and now it is. So between at 6 o'clock there was a population explosion on this classroom. Now, if we look at the vastness of the time span of the universe, even according to science, the time for which census has also been taken, that itself is limited. And for us to make a categorical statement based on that, it is a huge extrapolation from the available data. Just as population may have increased here in this classroom, but what about elsewhere? Students have come here, they're not being created, they came from somewhere else here. So similarly, when we understand that the human population is not a closed system for souls, there are other sources, then that problem doesn't come. Is that your question? Any other questions? One last question.
Yeah. You're saying that science explains everything that's explainable and God explains everything that science is able to explain, then by that logic, what explains God?
Okay. So the question is, what explains God? Yeah. Every system of knowledge begins with certain definitions. And without understanding those definitions, we cannot move forward in any branch of knowledge. In geometry, something with no dimensions is called a point. Something with one dimension is called as a line. Now, a line is a set of points. If I use the logic of algebra, how can accumulation of zero dimension entities create a one dimensional entity? It's like a sum of zeros creating one. It doesn't make sense. So this is an axiom in geometry. So every field begins with certain definitions. So the definition of God is sarva karana karana, the cause of all causes. Now, this definition is the foundation for explaining everything based on a God-centered world. Now, any explanatory setup, if we take any school of any body of knowledge, it requires some terminal point. Without the terminal point, nothing will move forward. So, in materialistic worldview, if you see, where did the original matter come from? That itself again has to have an assumption. It was just there. Science, for example, if science is seen from an entirely non-spiritual perspective, it may say that the laws of nature exist as they are. So the now going forwards from this, this is the beginning definition of God. Because we live in a world of cause and effect, so we tend to think that every cause, every effect must have a cause. If a child reads a novel for the first time, and the child says, oh, there is a hero, there is a heroine, there is a villain. And then after reading the whole novel, the child comes to know, there is an author. And again, child again opens the book, where is the author in the book? But the author is not in the storyline, the author is not in the timeline. The author made the storyline and the timeline. And the author exists outside. So similarly, God exists outside the framework of time and space. And even from the point of view of pure logic, if we say that the cause of everything cannot have a cause. If it has a cause, then that will be the cause of everything. So we have to take the chain of causality to some terminal point. Even science has confirmed that the universe itself is not eternal. It had a beginning point. So the causal chain, wherever it stops, that stopping point is God. Materialism holds that matter is some tiny bit of matter is the cause. So they say that that is a singularity which has infinite energy, infinite temperature, infinitesimal mass, which is beyond mathematical description, beyond physical realization. No, it is, here we have science proposing something, necessitating something which is beyond science. Are you getting this, the point I'm making? Any school of thought has to come to a terminal point. And within a materialistic worldview, science comes to a terminal point which goes beyond science. If the science is materialistic. But the spiritual worldview doesn't require a terminal point which is beyond its worldview. The spiritual worldview says that, yes, there is God, and there is matter, and there is energy. There is consciousness. These are the energies of God. And so, if there were just a lump of matter, that will not create anything. But if there is an intelligent builder, that builder can create things. So God is the cause of everything. And God is the point where all explanations begin. And the alternatives to God, which are matter, if we say matter, matter itself does not have causal ability to produce anything. And the materialistic worldview requires something which is outside of itself to begin with. A God-centered worldview does not require anything outside of itself to begin with. In that sense, God, if you understand the definition that he's the cause of all causes, then the search for all explanation ends in God. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Thank you.